This is Audible.
The Sacred Science by Nick Polizzi, an ancient healing path for the modern world. To my wife Michelle, who taught me how to laugh from the heart no matter what life brings, and to my two sons, River and Rowan, the greatest teachers I've ever known, this one's for you. Note to reader, woven throughout this book are practices and other pieces of native wisdom that you can put to use in your life right now. These practices were shown to me by the healers you are about to meet, and it is with their permission that I've included them in this book. Please, for your safety and the safety of those around you, be careful when experimenting with these techniques. They can be life-changing, but can also do harm if used improperly. Introduction. The afternoon heat in this place never disappoints. My left eye blinks away a nagging bead of sweat, while trusty forefinger and thumb locate and remove a mosquito on the skin just above my sticky t-shirt collar. The breed in these parts comes handily equipped with an anesthetic on its proboscis that numbs you as it drains your blood, so you don't feel the itch until the feast is over. No free lunches in this place, senor. I'm seated on the edge of a simple wooden chair, tucked in the corner of a thatch-roofed jungle kitchen, somewhere along the Amazonian border of Brazil and Peru, staring down the barrel of a very intimidating, albeit colorful, jug of liquid. The weathered brown hands on the native fellow holding it out in front of me speak to the decades he has spent navigating the bush, like the generations who have come before him. His name is Arturo, and he is the village curandero. Men and women of this ancient profession are thought to have an extrasensory relationship with the local plant spirits, which allows them to harness their power to cure the sick. I've heard it said that true curanderos, or shamans, are born with this skill and have little choice but to follow the calling. Arturo, who comes from a long line of medicine men, promised to bring me some of his family's legendary elixir for strength and vitality, and well, here it is. The liquid inside the repurposed 2-liter soda bottle on the table before me is mostly transparent, revealing a cluster of twigs, leaves, seeds, and insect thoraxes floating within. This is what men and women in my tribe drink every day before we go out to work. It's got 20 different ingredients and packs quite a kick. We all use it to heal head pain. Arturo holds the bottle up to the light, proudly identifying each of the floaters and sharing a bit about what they do to enhance the brew's potency. The word heal is a tricky one. These four letters seem straightforward in the modern world, but around here, healing can involve just about anything, from a bandage and some aloe on a scraped knee to an all-night plant ceremony that brings you as close to your existential edge as you can get, short of death itself. Heal stems from the old English word hal, which evolved into two other terms as well, whole and holy. 10 years ago, I would have thought these three words were totally unrelated, but staring into the eyes of the shaman before me, I now know better. They're as intertwined as the jet-black braid resting on his left shoulder. "Are those insects in there?" I ask, knowing the answer. "These? Fire ants. They have a painful bite, but their bodies contain powerful medicine. Really good for you." I smile and nod with feigned excitement. He twists off the fat plastic cap with an Inca Cola logo on it, and to our surprise, the bottle burps out an effervescent hiss, like a bottle of, well, Inca Cola. "Salud." Arturo pushes the bill of his well-worn trucker hat back from his brow and brings the full bottle to his lips, lifting the butt end high in the air. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 strong pulls later, he lets out a long, "Ah!" followed by, "Ooh-wee, this is a strong batch." Then it's my turn. "Prueba, mi amigo," he urges. Judging by the look of casually disguised queasiness on the face of Arturo, who grew up drinking this stuff, I'm fairly confident it will not be a dull experience. There's a special mental place I like to go in moments like this. My line of work calls for a mildly insane streak to begin with, but repetition helps hone a peculiar skill that allows you to jump into these rabbit holes with less resistance from all those pesky survival instincts. This is a place of no thinking. There is no benefit in fearing or speculating what will happen next, nor is there a shortcut around these obstacles. They are precisely where your path is meant to take you. The only thing to do is step forward and be ready for anything. A Taoist priest once shared a piece of wisdom that I find myself reaching for as Arturo offers his potion, about a student of Kung Fu and his master. As the student's training advanced, his master would come at him with increasingly intense flurries of punches and kicks, fists thrusting through the air, interspersed with painful blows from able feet. The student's natural inclination was to try and calculate what the master would do next, but the dance unfolded too quickly for formulaic thought, each second loaded with 5 to 10 strikes that could come from any direction. If the master ever sensed that his pupil was using a pattern defense against his attacks, the punishment would be severe. Never anticipate, said the master. Always be ready. Salud. I nod at my smiling friend, hoping I'm hiding my own preemptive queasiness better than he's hiding his. Up goes the bottle, and down goes the long-lost elixir of youth. The following true story is told through the eyes of an average white American male from New England, who thought he knew something about himself and the world, until he dipped a toe into the world of shamanism and realized rather suddenly that he did not. In this book, you will meet a number of odd characters. Among them are two shamans, a vegetalista with an encyclopedic mind for medicinal jungle plants, a band of 8 fearless patients willing to do anything to heal their illnesses, and my rough and tumble film crew. You may be asking yourself, what business does an ordinary guy from Connecticut have trekking through the pristine tropics of South America? Very good question. My name is Nick, and after healing naturally from a serious health challenge in my mid-20s, I decided to dedicate my life to an exploration of the ancient healing arts. This journey took me to the corners of the world, into the villages and homes of indigenous people who still use the sacred medicines and ceremonies of their ancestors. Somewhere along the way, fate landed a camera in my hands, and it became apparent that guerrilla-style filmmaking was a great way to preserve this fast-fading shamanic knowledge and bring these vital healing secrets to those in need of them. But some things are too expansive to be adequately captured on film, and anyone who has spent time in the tribal lands of the Amazon jungle or neighboring Andes mountains will tell you there is enough mystery here to fill lifetimes of exploration. So I'll be lending you the 20/20 lenses I was born with in my eye sockets for the ensuing chapters, as we dive into an unlikely healing expedition that was supposed to be an intrepid documentary, but turned out to be a portal of infinite transformation. My crew and I thought we were setting off to make a daring movie that would put the indigenous medicines of the rainforest to the ultimate test on real patients. It never occurred to us that we'd have to rewire our reality and confront the forgotten parts of ourselves in the process. This book is all about shamanism, a word that is shrouded in mystery and often misinterpreted. So before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's get clear on what exactly that term means. The word shaman itself is Tungusic, originating in the remote Altai Mountains of Siberia. It translates literally to one who knows. In the traditions of Siberia, Mongolia, and parts of China, the word is used to describe an individual who bridges the physical world and the realm of the spirits in order to bring balance to their tribe and heal the sick. They accomplish this by entering altered states of consciousness, whether induced by drum, psychoactive plant medicine, controlled exposure to enclosed heat, or other environmental aid. Anthropological evidence of shaman figures can be found in cultures all around the world, dating back to our prehistory on this planet. One such example lies in a 5,000-year-old cave painting in Tassil, Algeria, that depicts a shaman with the head of a bee surrounded by mushrooms. Older cave paintings found in France and Spain depict hybrid animal humans that many historians believe are shamanic in nature as well. The name used to describe this position of healer priest in society varies with the native language of each particular region, but remarkably, the basic role and techniques used do not. A large number of the rites used by medicine men and women from different corners of the world are undeniably identical, aimed at pulling back the veil of this reality in order to purify the patient from within. Hardliners argue that because true shamanism originated in the forests of Siberia and Mongolia, only the native healers from these regions should be referred to as shamans. but native healers from the Americas, Africa, Australia, and Europe with similar practices utilizing altered states are often referred to as shamans as well because the term so precisely describes their craft. Shamanism is often referred to as a lineage of direct transmission because shamanistic knowledge is passed down by word of mouth from generation to generation without any written account. In teaching an apprentice, a shaman not only shows him or her the ceremonial practices and medicinal herbs, but also demonstrates how to be in this world. Shamans are a living bridge between this dimension and the one we cannot see. Their fate is predetermined by their bloodline or through an unintended initiation, which usually manifests as a close encounter with death. I have grown to know and deeply respect a number of these men and women, but they do not share their knowledge lightly. Centuries of oppression, as well as the exploitation of native traditions, have all but wiped out these lineages. The true wisdom keepers that remain have learned to keep their ancestral knowledge safe, sharing it only with a select few whom they trust. One cardinal rule of the documentary filmmaker is to earn the trust of your subject while never forgetting what your job is, to document, not participate. But when it comes to highly sacred and often private shamanic ceremonies, not participating can be harder than it sounds. Chapter 1. Descent. If we surrender to Earth's intelligence, we could rise up rooted like trees. Rainer Maria Rilke. June 18th, 2016, Larapata, Peru. I'm in a pickup truck on a one-lane dirt road, hugging the side of a cliff about 16,000 feet above sea level in the middle of the Andes Mountains. We're on our way to a remote region where the majestic highlands plummet suddenly into a flat sea of Amazon jungle green. Roman, a 38-year-old shaman, is at the wheel, honking the horn as we whip around each blind turn to make sure any oncoming trucks know to stop. We're in a bit of a hurry, with only 90 minutes of daylight left and a 2-hour hike at the end of this ride before we reach what Roman affectionately calls the land. Nestled into one of the seemingly infinite valleys along this eastern slope is the new home of the Paititi Institute, where our documentary The Sacred Science was filmed. We're going to be doing a few ceremonies with the shaman's apprentices there, both ayahuasca and coca, and also filming some of the healers in the region. Little do we know that getting to Paititi will be just as medicinal as the center itself. We will be descending 4,000 feet on foot, through 3 different climate zones, into the Mapacho River Valley, then crossing 2 rope bridges before finally climbing partway up the other side of the valley and into the camp. This arduous new journey is a far cry from arriving at the Institute's previous location, where a van could take visitors from a small airport all the way to the Paititi grounds. As our Toyota Helix rumbles down the narrow gravel road, the alpine vegetation around us begins to change to a lusher, more tropical variety. We're getting closer to the Amazon, and I can feel the moisture and warmth blowing up the mountain and into the small truck's open windows. 20 minutes later, we reach an outpost farming village of about 200 people. The last semblance of civilization until we reach Paititi. Roman has a contact in town who stores the truck on his land and provides mules and pack horses to transport supplies down into the valley. While my colleague Moline and I strap on our backpacks, Roman asks a few locals if they can pack the food and equipment we have in the bed of the pickup onto the animals and bring it down the following day. It's never reassuring when the local Quechua, who know these lands like the back of their hands, look at each other and chuckle at the prospect of a pair of foreigners and their shaman guide trying to descend into the wilderness that lies beyond, in the fading light of a setting Peruvian sun, no less. But these trips to Paititi are always a lesson in trust. Trust in Mother Nature and trust in the divine plan. Onward. As we begin our descent, Roman warns that going down will be much more challenging than coming back up because of the unrelentingly steep incline. If you don't bend your legs with each step, using only your thigh and calf muscles to absorb impact, your knees will be shot in no time. Down we go, carefully placing each foot on the path below, pushing ourselves to move more rapidly than we would ordinarily dare on terrain like this, as we race against disappearing daylight. The old Incan route is barely wide enough for one person, carving its way along a perilous valley wall that drops sharply for miles until it ends abruptly at a thin blue stretch of river far below. The left side of the trail is adorned with all manner of plant life, but the right is non-existent, the earth underfoot ending just inches away from certain death. Dropping into beautiful patches of wildflowers, golden blades of alpine high grass, and clusters of wild strawberries, we keep a wary eye on the ledge that lies just one misplaced footstep away. About 20 minutes in, we come upon the ruins of an ancient Incan fortress strategically perched on a ridge with a commanding view of mountains and valleys in all directions. Mindful of the time, we admire it on the go, stopping for only a moment to take it in. 30 minutes later, we begin to hear the faint rumble of the Mapacho River far below. Roman yells back to us that we are halfway there. I can't tell by his cheery tone of voice whether or not he's toying with us. I yell back to him that I don't believe him. But he stops momentarily and gives me the medicine man look that I've come to know means he's not playing around. Daylight is just about gone, and now we're in a little bit of a pickle. We're tired, and being tired while traversing a challenging mountain trail is a recipe for potential disaster. But if we slow down, we'll be trying to navigate the walls of this valley in complete darkness. About 50 feet ahead, Roman yells back. Okay, we're about to enter the most difficult stretch. Pay very close attention to what you are doing. Pure presence. Don't get distracted. I echo Roman's words back to Moline, who is stepping quickly through the dusk about 50 feet behind me. He responds with a partly intelligible, "Got it," presumably not wanting to waste any more air than is necessary. Once we've traversed the ridge, we see immediately what Roman was talking about. The trail goes from packed earth to a steeper grade under loose rocks and an even steeper cliff to the immediate left side. It gets to a point where there is no room for even the slightest thought or conversation of any sort. One of those situations when you know your life may hang in the balance with each second that passes. We breathe harder as we go. It becomes too steep to walk, so we accelerate into a crouched trot, our headlamps turned on and pointed at the ground directly underneath us. I hear a subtle voice inside begin to chatter. What in the hell have you gotten yourself into? You've gone too far this time. Responding to the voice, I tense up momentarily, glance over the ledge down into the ravine, and trip over a rock underfoot. Lurching forward, I grab onto a small shrub to keep myself upright and on the path. Close one. I involuntarily start repeating a mantra to myself. One step at a time. Eyes on the path, not on the edge. My breath is my friend. Trust in nature. I say these words over and over to keep other thoughts out of my mind and the fear at bay. As the terrain becomes more treacherous, the trot turns into more of a dance, each step following the rhythm of the mantra and conforming to the shape of each rock and curve ahead. No thinking. Just doing, reacting, surviving. The spirit of the valley courses through my body as fear gives way to joy. A spirit, gliding through the night, begins to ask some rather innocent questions of the body it inhabits. Whose nose is this that is smelling the warm, high jungle breeze? Whose brow is this, dripping with salty sweat? I've lost understanding of who Nick Polizzi is, and gained the understanding of who I am. There's no ego left. I've become the valley around me. It might seem counterintuitive, but my built-in self-preservation instincts are not needed to stay alive on the mountain. Up ahead, I see Roman's headlamp suddenly stop advancing and turn back at me. I approach the bright beacon in the dark. Okay, he says, in a winded voice. The worst is behind us. We're almost there. 25 minutes later, we're crossing an old rope bridge that creaks as we walk over the turbid waters of the Mapacho River. The remaining quarter-mile hike partway up the other side of the ravine feels effortless compared with the descent. Before we know it, we're entering the Paititi camp, greeting the staff and students who wait for us. That night, as we eat dinner with Roman and three of his apprentices, I share the experience of becoming no one on the mountain. Roman smiles a big toothy grin. It's amazing how fast our illusions fall away when our life is on the line, isn't it? We're sitting cross-legged on thick alpaca blankets in an adobe structure known as the Temple. It's the largest building on this 1,000-hectare plot, serving as both meeting place and dining hall for all the patients, students, permaculturists, and healers who work here. As the shaman speaks, I notice that two of his apprentices are sharing a separate reaction to my story. Elton, a former Michelin star-rated chef from the small island nation of Malta, is the first to speak, in a melodic accent. Nick, it's a beautiful coincidence that you lost track of who you were on your way down the valley. We choose one question to meditate on each night. Before you arrived, Anthony, Stella, and I chose tonight's question. Guess what it is? They all look at me, waiting for me to guess, before Anthony breaks the suspense and answers the question for me. It's, who am I? In another life, I would probably have looked skeptically at this type of coincidence, but the past 5 years have been a series of perfectly placed episodes of synchronicity. The Sacred Science, my documentary about Amazonian shamanism that brought Roman and me into each other's reality, was a spiderweb of undeniable coincidence that seemed impossible at first, but has since become as normal as a starry night. This is not to say that I take synchronicity for granted. It has become an indispensable navigational tool on this ancient road into the unknown, a shining beacon in the dark that always seems to show up when I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. Like cairns on a mountain trail, these unexpected alignments of circumstance confirm that your compass and contour map are pointing you in the right direction. I smile and half bow to the three apprentices before turning to Malene. Looks like we came to the right place. Isn't it beautiful that we haven't even sat in tomorrow's ayahuasca ceremony yet, and there are already major shifts happening for you? Roman asks. What a gift! His eyes are a mixture of compassion and amusement, like he's watching his younger brother learn his way around a pack of firecrackers the hard way. Roman and I have known each other for 10 years, during which time he became one of my dearest friends, but moments like these are a humbling reminder that ours is also a shaman-student relationship. We don't grow by staying comfortable, Roman says. When we're at our edge, whether in ceremony or on an Incan trail in the darkness, we learn who is really at the wheel. But who is really at the wheel? My position coming into this trip was that the ego, that facet of personality in charge of self-preservation, was a hindrance in spiritual matters, but gravely important when it came to life or death situations and strategic choices. I'm not alone in that belief. Ever since Sigmund Freud put a name to it, and probably long before, scientists and naturopaths have generally agreed that the ego's core functions of judgment, control, planning, and defense are essential in keeping ourselves alive. But Roman takes issue with this model and has chosen it as a focal point for my education on this visit. You're going to have to learn that letting go and embracing the unknown isn't just something we do in ceremonies, he continues. Every moment of your life is sacred and loaded with subtle information that can only be witnessed by one who has clear sight. This can only be gained by letting go of who we are and the fear-based anticipation of what might happen next. Seeing what must be a look of confusion on my face, he dumbs it down for me. You still think you need to drive the car, but the wise man knows he is the car and the car is the road. You don't need to drive, Nick. You just need to trust. His point finally starts to sink in, leaving me inspired but agitated, a feeling that I've experienced many times over the past decade on the medicine path. The good news is that this nagging soul itch, usually brought on by a glimpse of something bigger than I have the capacity to integrate, tends to be a precursor to a personal breakthrough just around the corner. The idea of letting your heart guide you always sounded like New Age quackery to me when I was younger. But with the help of some very humbling purification rites, I've learned the hard way that, contrary to popular belief, my brain is not the control center. My journey has become a lesson in sitting still, listening with my heart for subtle bits of guidance that my brain cannot and will never be able to process. The descent into the Mapacho Valley had been a living lesson, an awakening demonstration of how humans releasing the ego and operating from somewhere beyond can indeed take better care of themselves, even in a harrowing test of physical resilience and agility. In the shaman's company, these conceptual teachings about higher humanity have an eerie way of manifesting themselves soon after the words are spoken in real-life scenarios, which usually involve a healthy dose of fear. Roman pats Elton on the shoulder and looks at the rest of us. Let's head over to the chapel and chew some coca. It will be good to make an offering to Grandma and get used to the space before tomorrow's ceremony. Letting go. The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness. John Muir. Ever have that feeling when you're walking in the forest and a sensation of home tingles up your spine? The natural world begins breathing you in and out, gently washing away all of your perceived problems, leaving you in a state of direct experience with the beauty that is. Wandering through meadows or over meandering tree roots or a crumbling wall of rock, you begin to see correlations between this ecosystem and the inner workings of your own mind. The more present you become with the soil under your feet and the character of the air moving into and out of your lungs, the more obvious your stresses and life challenges become. Everything in nature is in full communication. There is no one overseer, no hero, and no villain. Everything that transpires here is part of an ever-evolving cycle. Luckily, you don't need to take a trip to the Amazon to experience the essence of earth medicine. In fact, it can be far more empowering to do it in your own neck of the woods. A nature immersion exercise. A. Schedule 90 minutes this week to gift yourself. You will be embarking on a short voyage. B. Before leaving your house, remove all items from your pockets or backpack that could be a distraction, including cell phone, computer, magazines, newspapers, iPod, notebook, etc. C. Travel to a local forest or park. D. Upon arrival, walk until you find a space away from any man-made stimuli, including other people. Sit down. There is no need to close your eyes. Just be still. E. If possible, remove your shoes and socks, letting your feet touch the earth. F. Begin to watch the ticker tape of thought and notice how it fluctuates over the course of 90 minutes. Some things you may want to pay attention to. How long does it take for your mind to become extremely quiet? What triggers your mind to become hyperactive? What thoughts, positive and negative, begin to come up? What can you sense about your immediate environment? If you are working through a particular health challenge, what thoughts are coming up around this? If you listen with an open heart, the forest will begin to reveal its secrets to you, and along the way, it might help you reveal some of your own secrets as well. The six of us are sitting on the floor of a small Spanish chapel that must be at least 300 years old, making small talk by candlelight. The mountains of South America hold many small Christian holy structures like this one, no more than 10 feet across by 10 feet wide, with an ornate altar occupying the entire wall opposite the entryway. When the conquistadors first invaded these lands, they noticed that the local Incan people had built shrines and temples on certain points in the highlands that they felt were places of power. People would gather at these sacred structures to pray and give offerings to the Apus, the spirits, or gods of each mountain, asking for protection and insight. As a strategy to help force Catholicism onto this mysterious civilization, the Spaniards simply replaced these ancient places of worship with chapels like the one we're sitting in. The conquistadors knew the natives would still come to the sacred place, regardless of what type of building was there, and would slowly begin to embrace the prayers, beliefs, and one God of the Catholic Church. The chapels that remain today are things of beautiful simplicity, but the history and initial intention behind their creation are anything but. Boom! The corrugated metal roof above us shudders as the wind picks up outside. It's hard to believe it will stay attached to the rafters. The original roof on this thing was probably more aesthetically pleasing than quiet. The conversation stills as Roman nods to his apprentices, and they begin to unfold their small and intricately woven mesa blankets onto the floor before us. Next, they each produce a bag of green leaves from their medicine sacks, untie them, and grab handfuls to place in the center of each mesa square. Next, they take out identical jars of fine greenish powder, which they place very reverently next to each pile. Seeing as we will be doing an ayahuasca ceremony here tomorrow night, I felt that it would be a good idea for the six of us to have a coca ceremony to prepare the space tonight. This is a unique group of people who I feel are in high resonance with this path, and this is an opportunity for us each to connect and get better acquainted with this ancient structure. We've been chewing coca leaves since we arrived in the Andean city of Cusco last week. Coca, the same plant that is synthesized into cocaine, is one of the most sacred plants in South America, if not the most. It has been used for thousands of years as medicine, food, and ceremonial sacrament, and is what many maestros refer to as a power plant. One thing is for sure, it saved our asses these past few days. The reason why almost every one of the Quechua woodsmen in the high Andes chews coca is because, among its many other virtues, the leaf prevents altitude sickness and gives a sustainable boost of energy. I've experienced the energizing effects of coca in the past, but it wasn't until I was 13,000 feet up in the mountains that I realized its altitude-defying power. Earlier today, as we were driving over a particularly high mountain pass, the car had gone quiet as Malene and I were overcome with nausea. I began turning green. Roman shot me a quick glance from the driver's seat, then shook the bag of coca leaves next to him. "Keep chewing coca. Don't stop for a second up here. It's too high for us to keep moving at this pace without it." Malene and I did as we were told, stuffing a bunch into our cheeks, along with a small spoonful of Activator, a local mixture of ground leaves and baking soda. Within minutes, the nausea and dizziness were completely gone. Nothing like personal experience to substantiate the claims made around a traditional medicine. "Help by Kusinchis," Elton says, speaking the traditional Quechua blessing as he leans across the intimately close chapel floor to Roman, offering three attractive leaves pinched between index finger and thumb. His words translate in English to, "Let us chew coca together." "Erpiai sunquiai," Roman replies, uttering the traditional response, which means, "fluttering doves from my heart." He gazes into Elton's eyes as he receives the offering. The ceremony has begun. In a traditional coca ceremony, each participant chooses three unblemished coca leaves from the pile before him or her and forms them into a small bundle, or quintu, making sure that each one is facing stem down and green side toward the person who will receive it. The triad is then waved in front of the recipient's mouth while a prayer is blown into it by the giver. Once the bundle has been charged with the blessing, it is handed over. As the six of us make kintus for one another, atop what might be an ancient Incan power portal, a feeling of peace descends on the room. I haven't met these apprentices before, but there is no impulse to ask them about their lives or tell them about mine. The fact that Roman has brought us all here to meet is evidence enough of who we are and what we believe in. While we chew, he begins to tell the apprentices about Malene and me. Roman spends a few minutes recounting how he and I made a documentary film about shamanism here in the Amazon a few years ago, a roller coaster ride that somehow became a hit film. Elton and Stella nod approvingly, mentioning that they've seen it. "Thank you for creating that beautiful film," Elton says. "I watched it when it was first released." His eyes shimmer in the candlelight as he speaks. I smile and nod, my eyes lowering for a moment, a habit I've become painfully aware of over the past couple years. Creating the film took me the better part of 2 years and all the money I had, plus some hefty loans. And it has been viewed by more than 2 million people, spawning a thriving online community of seekers and natural medicine enthusiasts. Yet I still feel uneasy speaking about it with shamans, apprentices, and other native healers who are doing the real work on a daily basis. "What is your purpose on this trip, Nick?" Anthony, who has been silent until now, looks straight into my eyes as he speaks. Roman answers for me. "Nick is here to refine his process, see the essence of his and our work, and resolve some of the internal blocks that are still hindering him on this path." I smile widely at the group with a big cheek full of coca. His words are the truth, and it feels wonderful to have my vulnerabilities spoken out loud in a safe environment. Surprisingly, I don't feel any pangs of shame or defensiveness. With eyes trained on the candle in front of me, I add cautiously, "I'm hoping to ask Grandma for some guidance on a few issues in our ayahuasca ceremony tomorrow night. It's been a long time, and I've got a bunch of questions for her." "I have a feeling you won't have any time to ask questions in tomorrow's ceremony," says Roman, carefully assembling his next kintu. "Grandma hasn't seen you in a while, and there will be some deep purging to do." The shaman and his apprentices all laugh heartily at this, grinning at each other and back at me. Grandma is the affectionate yet always reverent name by which the shamanic community refers to ayahuasca, one of the most sacred and certainly the most hallucinogenic of the medicinal plants of the Amazon. And one rarely enjoys a visit with grandma without first relinquishing the contents of their stomach. I do my best to laugh along with the others, but a familiar sense of dread is already beginning to set in. It'll be 24 hours until we drink the Vine of the Souls, but her medicine is already beginning to reach out to me. Who in God's name would want to subject himself to the very real agony that Grandma Ayahuasca can bestow upon those who partake of her? As I sit there, my mind begins to engage in one of its favorite pre-ceremony pastimes, asking itself again how in the hell I got here. Chapter 2. Initiation. Your pain is the breaking of the shell that encloses your understanding. Khalil Gibran. I never intended for any of this to happen. I grew up Catholic in a small town in Connecticut, where the word spirituality meant going to church on Sundays, saying some quick prayers at night, and rushing through grace before supper on special occasions. Other than that, it wasn't spoken of much. There's a coldness of climate and demeanor in New England that only locals truly understand. People mind their own business, and in doing so they expect you to mind yours. This makes for quiet cul-de-sacs, charming but stuffy school settings, and plenty of well-kept secrets. It also creates awkwardness in places of worship. I could never tell if anyone was happy to be in our church. Aside from the priests, deacons, and altar boys, nobody really spoke or engaged in conversation. This was just fine by me because it allowed my brain to zone out and think about other things while my body performed the memorized routine. I'd see other kids I recognized from school in adjoining pews as we went up to receive communion, but it was only minimally acknowledged with a quick glance as if to say, "Oh, your family drags you here too." Stand up, listen, recite the appropriate response, sit down, and turn to a page from the prayer booklet. Stand up, repeat a few more words, then sit, then stand, and shake hands with your neighbor, then kneel this time instead of sitting, then get online to eat a dry wafer, recite a few more lines, and then go home. Maybe football will be on. My sister Liz and I always employed our own passive resistance strategies on Sundays. We'd take our sweet time getting ready, watching the clock in hopes that my mom and dad would become distracted and leave themselves too little time to make it to church. It was a 50-50 shot. Sometimes we got off the hook and quietly rejoiced. Other mornings, we piled into the car and got there early, like good Christians. Despite my dislike for the sermons at St. Joe's, I prayed diligently on my own every night throughout my childhood. This felt far more important. Some people talk about having a conversation with God through their prayers, but mine were one-way transmissions. I'd lie there in the dark and plead with him to watch out for my family and me, to forgive whatever I had done wrong that day. And then I'd wrap it up with a Hail Mary and an Our Father. I wasn't rejoicing in the existence of a divine and almighty creator. I was taking out a nightly insurance policy against the possibility that someday I'd die and have to answer to St. Peter for my transgressions, which were many. I felt this same motive from the other churchgoers while we sat there in our ergonomically challenged church pews. It seemed they were all there because they were fearful of what might befall them if they weren't. Generations and generations of fire and brimstone had culminated in this awkward collective of middle-class Americans who felt obligated to congregate and repeat words out of a poorly stapled pamphlet. My young mind had two main hang-ups with the religion I was born into. For starters, I couldn't get over the notion that a human being could behave as badly as he or she wanted to during the week and then get off scot-free by coming to church and confessing to a priest. I was convinced that this spiritual get-out-of-jail-free card had to be a man-made creation, not something from the heavens. I didn't have to go farther than the church parking lot to observe that the people I saw on a weekly basis at church were living in total contradiction to the ideals their holy book espoused, and then showing up on Sunday to clean the slate. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God, read the honorary lector, who had arrived in a brand new Beamer. Everyone agreed to do unto others as you would have them do unto you, just moments after jockeying for the best parking spot and quietly cursing the jerk who cut them off at the intersection. Second, and more important, I wasn't wired with the ability to accept how non-experiential it all was. Faith is the central pillar of the Roman Catholic Church, and I couldn't bring myself to trust that every word in the long book of God applied to me. I needed concrete proof that I was a soul being, temporarily occupying this capsule of flesh, bone, and blood called Nick. There was no community, no kumbaya circle of acceptance or unconditional love and compassion. The old Bible movies that my grandparents lived by depicted beautiful collectives of early Christians unified by their shared beliefs and mission to walk the earth emanating God's love. What transpired at St. Joseph's Church on your average Connecticut Sunday looked nothing like that. When I was 14, I noticed an odd-looking altar in Liz's bedroom that was adorned with candles, a few unrecognizable statues, a hand-woven rug, and an oversized book with the word Wicca written across the front. It was definitely intriguing, but only because it validated my suspicions at the time that my sister was a weirdo. I flipped through the book, taking in the drawings of naked women, pentagrams, and hoofed animals it contained. The magic spells, rituals, and vision-inducing plants of the Earth Goddess seemed very experiential and exotic. But it was like switching to the opposite team. Weren't they supposed to be the bad guys? It felt like a bad 80s movie, and it basically was. Spirituality left me altogether as I became a young man occupied with the usual distractions of an early 20-something. College friends, drinking and drugs, studying enough to get decent grades, falling in love with girls, more drinking, and ultimately entering into the grind of the workforce. Then, one day in late 2002, something happened that interrupted my ascent into middle-class obscurity. I was sitting in front of a computer screen when suddenly everything in my vision went bright and blurry. Imagine the kind of blindness that happens after you accidentally stare into the sun for a moment. It was like that, but gradually encompassed everything in my vision. I naturally panicked and began stumbling around, trying to get to the bathroom and splash cold water on my face. And then, just as suddenly as it started, the blindness stopped, and I could see perfectly again. I had no idea what had just happened, but I did the first thing I usually do when medical things happen that I can't explain. I began to phone my mom. I was about halfway through dialing her number when my brain screamed in an explosion of excruciating pain. I involuntarily curled up into the fetal position on the floor, shuddering with every new wave of intensity. I was in complete darkness in a soundless room for 8 hours. Before the pain finally began to subside. That week, I took my first ever trip to a neurologist and was told that I had experienced an ocular migraine headache. If you don't know what an ocular migraine is, I'll just say this. We're not talking about normal pain. This is a debilitating condition that can ruin your life, as it did mine for the first 2 years that I had them. Imagine the feeling of pushing on a broken bone or muscle tear, but in the center of your brain, continuously for 6 to 8 hours. The migraines would come on with no warning, and the pain often reached such intensity that I'd lose the ability to form words or communicate. My girlfriend at the time witnessed many bouts of unnerving behavior during these spells. One day, she came home to our apartment to find me huddled under a blanket in the bedroom, unable to respond to anything she said. I tried to piece a sentence together, but all that came out was a garbled mess that didn't make any sense. It wasn't that I was mumbling. The actual words I was saying were random and wrong. I tried to tell her that I needed a glass of water, but all that came out was, "Baseball dog handed over?" My doctor, one of the most highly regarded neurologists in Connecticut, prescribed a number of different drugs to combat the headaches. Each would provide some temporary relief, but ultimately lost its effect after about 2 migraine episodes. I went back to the doctor one day, and he told me that the only remaining option was to start taking a preventative medication that was only 50% effective and would certainly change my moods and alter my perception of reality. That's where I got off the modern medicine bus. It's interesting when life reveals a personal boundary that you never knew you had. I was anything but a naturopath at the time, but the idea of taking a medication that would change the way I perceived the world was completely out of the question, even if it meant bearing the brunt of this migraine pain without aid. Oddly enough, these headaches would turn out to be the biggest blessing I've ever received. Through a series of unforeseeable events, they delivered me onto the shamanic healing path I now walk. About a week after I gave up on modern medicine, I was in the middle of yet another serious migraine when the phone began to ring. I wouldn't usually pick up the phone during an episode, but I saw that it was my best friend, also named Nick. He knew what I was going through, and always had a bit of encouragement or sympathy that made me feel slightly better. I mumbled hello and told him that I was in the thick of a bad episode, and had to go because it hurt even worse to talk. "I know it hurts, but please try something with me. I think I've got something that will help you." Nick told me he had just learned a natural pain relief technique called EFT that was supposedly really effective for migraine pain, and that he could teach me how to do it right over the phone. I agreed to stay on for another 5 minutes and give it a shot. A moment later, he was instructing me on how to tap on different points on my face and upper torso while saying a series of affirmations out loud. It took every bit of strength I had to sit upright and follow his quirky DIY Chinese acupressure lesson. But about 3 minutes into it, he asked me a question that shook me to my core and awakened something that I'd never felt before. "If your pain were a person, who would it be?" An image of a close family member flashed across my awareness, along with a particular setting inside a car that I knew very well. I had had a painful argument with this individual over something this person had done that really disturbed me a few years earlier. As I watched the scene swirling through the static of migraine turmoil, I had an unexpected emotional release. Tears filled my eyes, and as they did, the madhouse inside my head quieted. The pain began to drain. Within 10 minutes, 90% of my pain was gone. Nick was as flabbergasted as I was. "Wait, really?" he asked. "Dude, I told you this stuff worked." I was astonished and exhausted. We spoke for a few minutes, then I got off the phone and fell into a deep sleep. Apparently, the intense emotions around this painful event had continued to burden me long after the actual encounter had passed. From that day on, the migraines became far less frequent, and when they did occasionally occur, the pain and other symptoms were milder than a normal headache. The act of turning toward a blind spot in the shadows of my psyche and acknowledging its existence was a maiden voyage for me. Until then, I'd had no idea that it was possible to access the causes of personal suffering and work to alleviate them. With this one glimpse, I was quickly hooked. I had to keep digging. This pivotal migraine experience unlocked a new intuitiveness in me. Almost as if I had gained access to an extra sense, I now began seeing more subtle aspects of my reality that were out of balance. I began to examine all of my seemingly innocent habits, behaviors, and patterns for anything that elicited a bad idea response in my gut. Within a few months of probing, I discovered that drinking coffee and eating sharp cheeses were the cause of the remaining 10% of my migraine headaches. So I stopped, and so did they. This combination of ancient Chinese acupressure and some small alterations in my diet turned out to be more effective than any drug that I had tried. It had also unblocked a part of me that had been wounded for such a long time. Oddly enough, this disruptive migraine saga is also how I got into filmmaking. Without the headaches, I would be somewhere else right now, doing something that isn't nearly as satisfying as writing this book. Until the triumph over my chronic headaches at age 26, I'd never had a real calling in life. Early on, my folks pointed out that I was good at drawing, a craft that I honed on the pages of textbooks and the margins of test papers, ultimately landing me in design school. But this was just surface-level stuff. There was no real purpose or identification with something greater. Natural medicine and the exploration of human consciousness wasn't a vocation. It was a path. My heart was tugging me towards something much larger than myself, showing me flashes of a life spent helping others see the tremendous power of ancestral healing methods. You can go through your entire life without ever noticing that Buddhist temple down the street, or the Ayurvedic herb shop a few towns over. They are part of somebody else's culture until the day you become a refugee of the belief systems you've been relying on. They are part of somebody else's culture until the day you become a refugee of the belief systems you've been relying on. Until the day you are desperately seeking answers in the face of a disease or crisis that isn't adequately addressed in the owner's manual you inherited from your family, your community, or your culture of origin. The natural food shop down the street from my Park Slope apartment in Brooklyn became a mecca. The jars of herbs, shelves of books on Eastern philosophy, and overall demeanor of the individuals who ran it were therapeutic in themselves. After having put all my chips on modern medicine and lost, the world of folk medicine reached out and began to show me the old way of caring for oneself and for others who are sick. The universe is funny. Once you're dialed into a calling, the cosmic gears begin turning behind the scenes, ultimately aligning you with an improbable opportunity to express your gifts and serve your purpose. Two friends, Kevin Gianni and Nick Ortner, the same Nick who helped me cure my migraines, called me up one day and said they were in the middle of making a documentary about the tapping technique that healed me, EFT, or Emotional Freedom Technique. But they had hit a roadblock and needed some advice. You need advice from me? What do I know about filmmaking? I was sure they were kidding. You went to design school. Didn't you take any photography courses there? I could tell by his tone that Ortner was actually being serious. I laughed out loud. You guys must be in a lot of trouble if the future of your film relies on my one semester of college photography. Listen, we've got a bunch of camera gear, but we're not sure how to use it. Can you come out here and take a look? A day later, we were standing in a basement staring at a bunch of video and audio gear that was still in the box. I put my game face on and began pulling things out and assembling them. Yeah, I can figure this out. A month later, I had taken over the production side of the film, traveling around the country to interview a number of thrilling thought leaders in the world of health and wellness. We stood behind those cameras extracting empowering bits of wisdom from our subjects about the potential of the human organism to heal itself, and were almost always left grinning with excitement after our subjects had left the room. But as we started assembling the footage in the editing room, I realized there was something obvious missing. Real patients using EFT and getting better. Natural medicine is people's medicine. In 90% of the world, traditional approaches are still turned to first, before modern treatments are ever considered. Our work had to involve real people, putting this approach to the test in real time and speaking candidly about their experiences. We decided to host a 4-day healing retreat in a rural town in Connecticut, inviting 10 patients with varying ailments from psychological conditions like PTSD and depression to chronic pain and breast cancer to come and work with the best EFT practitioners in the world. Each day, our team filmed their healing journeys in the most unobtrusive manner possible, capturing not only the profound physical breakthroughs, but the underlying mental and emotional transformations as well. We were left with compelling documentary proof that it worked, as well as a living testament to the bravery of patients who are willing to confront the psychological blind spots creating disharmony in their lives. It was my first film and it shows, but we had pointed our cameras at something that was hard to look away from, real human beings putting it all on the line to get their lives back. And like that, I became a documentary filmmaker in the world of health, wellness, and spirituality. My modus operandi in the projects I take on is to focus on stories of real patients let down by modern medicine as they try a specific alternative therapy or natural medicine. This desire to prove the effectiveness of folk healing methods probably comes from the same place as my childhood intolerance for the religious indoctrination at St. Joseph's, an absence of blind faith, and a stubborn need for concrete, experiential evidence. It could also be a simple longing, as a viewer of films, to see real people being honest about who they are and ultimately overcoming all odds. Whatever the motive, this documentary approach is far less predictable than creating an archival talking head film. These are real patients who are putting their trust in you to help them, and we never take that lightly. This is a combination of consciously filmed reality and quasi-scientific experimentation with natural medicine, but it's always done in a highly controlled environment. What I was about to propose for our next film was almost impossible to control and about 100 times as risky. The vision was to bring 8 sick individuals into the middle of the Amazon rainforest, more than 1,000 miles from what would pass as a modern hospital, to work with the undiscovered plant medicines of the indigenous shamans there. My friends thought I was absolutely nuts, and in retrospect, I probably was. Chapter 3: Crisis and Ceremony. Synchronicity is an ever-present reality for those who have eyes to see. Carl Jung. November 17th, 2009. Brooklyn, New York. I'm in the crammed makeshift office attached to my third floor Brooklyn apartment, taking notes on an academic text by ethnobotanist Richard Evans Schultes. Window is open, fan is on, and the murmur of Flatbush Avenue traffic fills the room, occasionally punctuated by a siren or horn. For months, I've been poring over classical and contemporary texts about medicine men, bone setters, wise women, and shamans from different cultures in North and South America and around the world. I'm learning about the medicines they use, the ceremonies they perform, the rites of initiation they must go through, delving night after night into just about every text about native medicine and spiritual rites that I can get my hands on. I've been mapping out any tribes across the globe that have a lineage of ancestral knowledge that is still partially or fully intact. I'm overcome with an itch that is probably familiar to most journalists and documentarians. Shamanism is where our next film is, but I can't seem to find my way into it. If the goal were simply to document shamans and their sacred practices, I would assemble a film team and venture off into the outback of any of the 6 non-icy continents, letting the story unfold as we investigated. But this is not that type of project. The small team that I've assembled so far, my girlfriend Michelle, an art director at HBO, my cousin Dan, a producer at CNN, and little old me, is in unanimous agreement about what would make for the most compelling, albeit slightly insane, documentary. Our plan is to bring 8 patients with serious illnesses to some remote region of the planet where a group of indigenous healers will attempt to make them well using traditional methods. It's a total reach and fraught with potential disaster. There has never been a documented trial of the healing practices used in indigenous cultures. To the contrary, these tribes are considered to be primitive and uneducated, despite the fact that many of our modern medicines are derived from plants that they discovered and generously shared with Ivy League botanists. In our eyes, there's only one way to do this film right: with real people, real illnesses, real cures. We've decided that our target region of the world will be the Amazon rainforest. Not only does this gigantic stretch of wilderness hold countless shamanic traditions that are still alive in their original form, but the forest floor itself is home to more than 65,000 species of largely unstudied plants, many of them medicinal. Our logic is that the combination of shamanic intervention and the vast living pharmacopoeia of the Amazon will stack the healing odds in our favor. Plus, the warm temperatures of the jungle seem mildly less intimidating than the other leading option, the frozen steppes of the Siberian and Mongolian outback. The core problem that we face is one of procuring the right talent. And our exploratory trips to South America has become quite evident